it's kind of weird when you think about it that the difference between a maverick scientist and just a crazy scientist is if they have success, right?
Welcome to Further Research Needed. Please leave your lab coats by the door. I'm Hannes Feirer and I'm joined by my co-hosts and friends,
Jan-Philipp Reising
and Chris Wood.
This is the podcast with straightforward questions and not so straightforward answers. Today we ask the question, does the maverick scientist narrative bypass the scientific process? Before I get into that, I said cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Clink. So I think before we can start discussing about this question, I have to introduce first, obviously, one word. What do you mean with the maverick scientist and this maverick scientist narrative? And second, what does it mean to bypass the scientific process? First off, the maverick scientist narrative is this persona a scientist creates around themselves in the public, but also in the academic space. Kind of this going against the stream, being the underdog, holding a truth that is not recognized by the mainstream, one against all the rest. And this is something we saw a lot in history, but we also see it still today, especially in public spaces like Twitter, but also on conferences. And I think we see it especially in when scientists engage with the public without other scientists, just by themselves, educating the public. I think I see it quite often that scientists then present themselves a bit as the underdog. I think this is particularly interesting because it is a narrative, a story a person tells about themselves. And as humans, we are captivated by narratives. While science technically should be about an argument, about a fact, not about a story. But in the end, we write papers as stories, right? All of us know when we write a publication, we say, like, do you have the story together or not? Do we have your argument together? Because we end up selling science today as stories. And in the same way, we also, or some people at least, craft a story, a narrative around themselves. And I think there are two kinds of maverick scientists. There is the academic type, which I just mentioned, which creates this persona on Twitter, on the way they tweet, the way they interact with other scientists. They might be complaining about, oh, my paper was rejected. The mainstream community doesn't understand that I have the truth of this particular subject. Or on conferences, they might be very controversial. And we can discuss if this is a good thing or not. And the other part would be a scientist, or very importantly, a pseudoscientist who talk to the public about their work. And this way, it allows them to promote their science or pseudoscience as true because they kind of raise this argument of, it is me, I hold the truth against the mainstream, and I'm rejected like many other people have been rejected before me. Like, you know, that one person can be right against the entire mainstream. And this is the narrative they create to get a lot of attention. This works for two reasons. A, because of the sympathy for the underdog. This was seen very clearly in, oh no, don't pin me down on the date, the football, or for the Americans, the Soccer World Cup 2000, I don't know, maybe 14, when Iceland won so many games. Iceland, a country with how many, 300,000 people and not a very strong football history, was super successful in the World Cup and everyone was rooting for them. Even the people of the countries that lost were rooting for Iceland because they were the underdog who was super successful all of a sudden. It's a narrative we like. And the other aspect next to the underdog is that history has shown that a single person can be right against 5,000 other people, against the entirety of the church, for example. Galileo, Copernicus were right against those. Therefore, it's kind of easy to raise this as, not really as an argument, but as a supporting cause for why being right is rather likely. Does that make sense to you guys? Do you agree so far?
Yeah, definitely. I think the the last thing sort of reminds me of survivorship bias. So, or maybe like, basically you look at all the famous people and you're like, you try to figure out, oh, what is it that makes them so successful? And you figure out, oh, all of them eat bacon. And then bacon is the one thing that makes them super successful. And I feel like it's, which is obviously not true because you don't see all the failures. And I feel like they're using that kind of argument, right? They are saying, all of these people were against the mainstream and look, they turned out to be correct. But obviously you don't see all of those people who were incorrect in history and that don't show up in your history books, right?
Right, that makes sense. So you mean in this case, it's kind of a flawed argument. It's not very likely that a single person is correct against a vast majority. I think where we see this a lot right now is in climate change, right? Where the consensus of the scientific community is climate change is man-made, but there are still a few people, who even scientists, who keep denying that.
Yeah, a very small proportion. And I feel like it's the kind of argument they are making is just not very valid. It's just very unlikely that you are correct in face of overwhelming scientific consensus, which doesn't mean it doesn't happen, right? That's like you're saying, it's like such a good story if you are the only one who figured it out.
I think it'd be really interesting to look back at how many failed maverick proposals there were of people being like, don't believe germ theory. It's, you know, it's tiny gremlins that live exclusively on fruit that cause all of the world's illnesses. I mean, there's so many of them now. But if you went back and looked, I think it would be quite interesting.
Do you mean now, I'm not sure if you're confusing now or if you're mixing the maverick scientist narrative, like a single person going against the mainstream then, maybe even the flawed mainstream, or if you mean the theories people were holding then, which were wrong, and we know this today, maybe because of a maverick scientist.
No, I just think there could be, Philip was saying, like there could be a lot of failed maverick scientists out there in history that we don't hear about anymore because they failed.
I think absolutely. I think what a topic that I personally find very interesting are superseded theories and basically what people believed back then, which we don't anymore today. But these were not mavericks. This was consensus back in the day. Like the homunculus theory that in the germ cells that we had a tiny human in the germ cells and it would just grow. Like they didn't have the concept of development of an embryo as we have it today.
I was just thinking there are examples of maverick scientists. So is it Lamarckian versus Mendelian genetics?
Versus Darwin, yeah.
So Darwin. In a way, Lamarck was he was potentially a maverick scientist. I'm not quite sure about the history of this, but he his form of genetics was held for a long time. You know, I think the Soviet Union really strove to use Lamarckian genetics.
Yeah, they did.
And then he's now subsequently been disproven, but he would have been fighting the mainstream.
Well, in a way, if we can briefly talk actual science, in a way he has been vindicated right now with epigenetics. Like on a genetic level, it's Darwinism and the idea that genes are selected for, not changed throughout the way we live, while the epigenetic layer is influenced by our environment and much more Lamarckian, if you will. So in this respect, I find especially this Darwin versus Lamarck case very interesting.
No, that's true.
But also the other thing,
it's kind of weird when you think about it that the difference between a maverick scientist and just a crazy scientist is if they have success, right? In the first thing, just you have to be unsuccessful for a long period of time to be even considered in that category. And then the difference between maverick scientists and just like a random crazy person is just if they end up being right in the long haul, which is like really weird as a concept, right? That you can't fall in either of those two categories, and probably within your lifetime you don't even know which one you are. I mean, maybe you believe in yourself, but
that's another interesting point, is that people, even if they were wrong often never gave up their belief. And the other way around, I guess it's not so surprising to us that people who were right never gave up their belief, but even if they were wrong, because in principle, the scientific method should allow us or kind of requires us to change our mind, right? While very often this was not ever the case. So people kept believing in the ether until they died, or people, even Einstein, kept not believing in quantum mechanics or parts of that, and to his death. And that's interesting, maybe also with the Maverick scientist narrative. The quote comes to mind from, what's his name, Max Planck: science advances one funeral at a time. So people don't actually change their minds as they should according to the scientific process, the method.
There's another selection bias, though, because in order to do science, you have to do a lot of experiments and have a lot of theories that fail day to day in the lab or under discussion and this sort of thing. And to have that tenacity to continue to do experiments until you find the truth, in inverted commas, you need to hold these theories close to your heart. So I wonder if people who change their minds quite quickly don't end up finding and espousing a controversial but eventually true theory.
I mean, because it needs a lot of persistence to push through all these minor failures you have on a daily basis as a scientist.
Yeah, so it's the evolutionary pressure, it's the selection pressure on scientists, is that only those sorts of people will survive in science. Yeah.
Makes sense.
On the other hand, you also have a selection for people who kind of throw away hypotheses that didn't turn out right. If you follow one hypothesis that you had in your first week of your PhD for 4 years, and you could have kind of like thrown that overboard after maybe a couple of weeks where it was pretty clear that it's not correct, then you're also not going to be successful, right? So you still like either have to be lucky or you have to have like a very good feeling for where it actually makes sense to persist. Like just persistence in and of itself is not enough. I think there's an extra component to it that's necessary.
Yeah, I would like to switch topic quickly because I didn't actually touch upon the last bit of the question we're asking. Again, the question is, does the Maverick scientist narrative bypass the scientific process? And what I want to ask is this Maverick scientist narrative, but also does it bypass the scientific process, or you could ask, does it aid or hinder the scientific process the way it should work? And what I mean with this basically is that the scientific process is a community effort. We peer review the papers of each other, and we work on things together. Very rarely it's only one person working on a specific question, but often it's a multitude of labs in either in collaborations or competition, but also this competition helps find the truth in one way or another, right? And when a person goes out and says, you're all wrong, but because I know and because you keep rejecting me, I don't have to engage in this process anymore, but I can kind of bypass it and try to influence policy or whatever it is, my own way, or maybe develop a technology without the science having been vetted by the community. The question is this a bypassing of the method? Is this bypassing, therefore, aiding the scientific process and progress, or is it hindering it?
So I think that is actually really interesting, because it's one of my top ways of triaging new theories or papers that I'm reading, or like ideas that come through, is that if the person who espouses this theory has subsequently left the community and is going down that narrative of, don't look at what I'm doing, the community's against me, I don't need peer review, I'm just going to do it as it is, then that instantly raises a huge red flag for me about anything they say, because they're moving away from that scrutiny. Whereas when a scientist who maybe self-mythologizes themselves as a maverick scientist and says, this is my theory, it goes against the grain, but, you know, come at me, come, you know, debate with me or do this, then that's much better. And I would be more prepared to read that paper and to accept some of the information, or at least try and think the way the paper is telling me to think.
Right.
But there's countless examples of scientists who, they often use the company framework to hide away. So they'll say, I've discovered this really great thing. I'm not going to explain it to you all because I've patented it. It's in a company now, and I can't talk about it. But just rest assured, I've changed the world. And that's always such a suspicious thing. Like, it's, you know, it's the kind of cold fusion and all these other mythological.
Right. So you're saying you're completely fine with people creating this narrative about being against the mainstream, as long as they don't reject the community effort.
Yeah, I think so.
Right. Yeah, interesting.
And I mean, like, really derailing science is very hard, right? Like, really hindering science as a whole is pretty difficult as a single person to do.
Oh, I don't actually think so. I think there are many instances. I can't think of anything right now, but I can imagine that people can lead a field astray and going and having an entire field run in the wrong direction for maybe personal reasons, because they created this narrative because they want to be successful. I mean, after all, personal, like, every scientist has a personal agenda. It pays their bills, right, at the end of the day.
I think that might be true, but then we're talking about a different kind of scientist, right? If you're like in that potential maverick science category, you're already going against the mainstream, then your problems are probably that you're not being published, you're ridiculed at conferences, so you basically don't get the recognition and the funding you need to keep pursuing your
right
science.
That's
so from that perspective, how are you supposed to kind of let the foundation of science crumble because of what you're doing? I think the really detrimental thing happens when you go to the public, and that interaction gets dangerous pretty fast, I think.
Right. At this point, I'm absolutely with you. Yes, I think it's, as long as the scientific process works, as long as grant agency are based on peer review and publications, and I'm not the biggest fan of the current publication system, obviously, but after all, this kind of works. As long as this is in place, a single person, as much as they try to be hailed as the successful underdog, they cannot take down the system. While as soon as they go out to the public and say, well, scientists don't believe me anymore, but I am right and I can heal you, or I can solve this issue for you or that issue for you, things become very dangerous.
I mean, there's a part of the scientific process that the going to other scientists and trying to convince them that you're right and addressing each and every question that they have is very necessary. You need to have that because they go, oh, that's a good theory, but what about if you take that theory into space or you put it in, you know, high pressure environments, high temperature environments, or so on and so forth. And that process strengthens, or, you know, it weans out the bad example or bad theories, and it enhances the stronger theories. And in a way, that kind of, we need that we need the maverick scientist myth to persist so that people constantly test theories against each other and grind away at each other so that then the better theory wins out. You know, you'd, because otherwise we just give up, right?
We've all not been very positive so far, and we saw the, so far in the discussion, the maverick scientist narrative as something negative against the scientific process or progress even.
I'm very ambivalent to it.
Exactly, sure. Me too. And we kept forgetting that many, many important scientists in the past have been exactly these people. They didn't necessarily create that narrative around them, but they were that because they did actually hold the truth and they were convinced of their data and fought for it despite overwhelming concerns of the mainstream.
I mean, then again, you only know of the people who were actually right in the end, right?
Right, but so the number of those is enormous.
But that's,
you don't know that because you're just like in the history books, you're only going to have the ones that were the underdogs and correct. You're not going to have all the people that were wrong.
But if you look at how fields advance, it's rarely ever the case that the whole field finds new data and then they all together agree that what they thought before is wrong. What is much more likely is that a single person has the good data that's rejected by everyone else until it's so overwhelming, or people, let's say there's a shift of generation and the new generation starts accepting the better data. You can say the old generation dies out. But that's something that has been seen a lot.
I completely agree with you that that happens, but I would challenge you how often that happens, because the other thing is, if you have one person that goes against the field and has like a very big step in progress, which correlates to how likely it is that the field rejects you, then you're going to see that jump in knowledge a lot more than if you have like slow incremental progress over decades. You know, like, let's say a maverick scientist, it needs 50 years for him to be acknowledged by the field, then that's like a perspective change, and it's like a huge difference that you can actually see. But if you have like 50 years of scientific progress where each year someone kind of adds a small puzzle piece, then it's just not as valid. You can't grasp it. The story is not as good, right?
Right.
So I think yes. There might be a lot of selection in history books going on that make it seem as if this process would happen a lot more than it actually does. Which is not to say that it doesn't happen or it's not important. I'm just saying, like, what is the actual portion of these things happening?
And I think this leads me to the question, is this narrative now something we should actually endorse and challenge? I think that's basically what Chris said earlier, that we should endorse this narrative but challenge it and challenge each other on very radical ideas. Because it's much more likely that the field actually advances faster than if we keep treading lightly and just go very safe step one at a time, rather than going for a big idea, which is most likely wrong, but with many big ideas, we're likely to find the right one and make a larger step quicker.
Yeah, for sure. You want that discussion, right? You want two people kind of fighting it out over their respective hypothesis.
That's something I'm missing so much in the current, at least in life science where I work, is that people don't actually work against each other on different hypotheses. They don't really challenge each other, but I feel like people try to avoid one another and find their niche where they can work peacefully by themselves, unchallenged by anyone, not in competition with anyone. Which makes sense if you want to keep getting funding, keep getting published, and want to maintain your position and want to keep making a living off what you do, but I'm not sure if that's actually very beneficial for science.
I think it really depends on which subfield of science you are in. If you think about method development, that's exactly what we're talking about. It's like maybe 3, 4, 5 labs worldwide competing to be the first one to get something to work or find a new amazing method or improve right. on the current method. Of course, that's not like a hypothesis or like a quantum leap and say progress in terms of knowledge, but I think there's a lot of competition, and I don't think you can generally say, oh, I wish there were more competition in science. I think that's already already too yeah, that, much that, that, competition.
That,
in
no, I think that is true. Chris, what did you want to say?
Well, I think it depends, because there's certain topics that we know are controversial and elicit debate, and they elicit both scientific debate and public debate. But there's also got to be a space for people to investigate things that aren't interesting to the public, and, you know, measure the phylogenetic differences of barnacles on different ships, just because we should look at that, and maybe that will turn out to be, you know, maybe there's information to be gathered on that. And in those cases, like, there probably isn't necessary to have a huge bust up in the theory of genetics about these poor barnacles. It's just, you know, information gathering, and, you know, eventually you'll be able to chart the progress of climate change across the oceans as you see this happen. But it's sort of, it requires people to work on that for that information to be gathered. It It depends, though, when you come to something that is controversial, how the debate is instigated and how it's, whether it's a beneficial debate and, you know, the scientists can disagree, but then, you know, the theory advances, or if it's a completely destructive debate. Often the debate bleeds over, like we've said, into the public sphere, and then, you know, it becomes politicized potentially, or it becomes a matter of religion, and these things aren't helpful, really.
Do you have a specific example in mind, Chris?
The greatest example for all of this is the MMR vaccine data. The paper's published by Andrew Wakefield that linked the MMR jab to causing autism, which is one of the worst examples of where correlation, causation were conflated. And he is a maverick scientist now. He's gone rogue in the sense that he will not engage in debate with the scientific community because he believes that the community is out to get him.
He went from being a maverick scientist to a rogue scientist.
That's my new word. we can have a whole other podcast on rogue scientists and what that means.
I have one in mind, but you keep going.
So, and he now does speaking tours in the US, and he is associated with the right wing US politics, vaccine denial, and everything that comes with that. By any quantitative measure, his effect on humanity has been negative. Like, there are more dead people in the world because of what he's done. And so in that sense, it's very, it's uncontroversial that the maverick scientist narrative, is bad. And in a way, it's because people outside of science still listen to him and still think, he could be right. You know, it's the classic conspiracy theory narrative of but big farmers coming to get him, or, you know, they're going to suppress
So this is then not based on fact, but on these two factors which I mentioned in the beginning, is that the people have sympathy for the underdog, for the one who's being rejected by the mainstream. And because history shows that one can be right against the consensus of everyone else. And they want to believe that, I forgot his name already.
Andrew Wakefield.
This guy. That he is right despite the overwhelming disagreement by the academic community.
Yeah.
Is that the two reasons that you think are responsible for that?
I think the maverick scientist narrative is useful when you wish to pick and choose what theory you want to use. Right? We only apply it when we want to apply the theory, the unproven theory. We're like, they could be right.
You know? Right. That's. I sound like a fanboy now. I think that's a very smart sentence. I think this narrative can be used to just confirm our beliefs.
Yeah.
And not challenge them.
To me, what it sounds like, what we're landing on almost, is that as long as you stay in the scientific community, the maverick scientist story is kind of beneficial because it pushes people against adversity to pursue their research and try to get better results and better data to prove what they think is the correct path or explanation. But the moment you step out and you kind of take that credibility of the science community without actually being part of the scientific community anymore, then it gets detrimental.
So that is somewhat related to something we talked about before, is that should the scientific discussion happen out in the public space, especially because kind of we as scientists, I'm not any of the three of us, but our predecessors have been painting this idea of science that is infallible and facts are facts and whatever science delivers is true. This is kind of the narrative of the 20th century, right?
Yeah, it's almost like a religion in some contexts.
Exactly. Then we would call it scientism. And we all know that is not how science works, right? So once we start having the scientific debate out in the public space, people start to lose faith in science. Because that's what it is at this point, it's faith. And if you have two controversial opinions, you gotta, as you said, pick and choose. And the Maverick scientist narrative helps you make this decision a bit easier, or I think they can abuse that a bit, this indecisiveness. Is that a word, Chris?
Yeah.
Of also this indecisiveness of the public in the during the scientific debate out in the public.
Yeah, for sure. But I really like the faith connotation here, that they lose faith, and it's not what we want as scientists, right? We don't want the general public to have faith in us, right? We want them to engage with us.
I think you and I don't want that, but I think the scientists for a long time wanted that. If you look at one of the big science communicators in the US, Bill Nye, do you know the guy?
Yeah, the science guy.
Bill Nye, the science guy, exactly. The guy with the bow tie. I think he's great, but he paints this image of science being self-correcting, infallible, or somewhat infallible. Once a fact is consensus, it's true. And I think what he, in his way of presenting science and communicating science, misses is the debate that is going on most of the time, and often is still going on after fact is accepted. And his view on communicating science is super vulnerable when a new field is undergoing, or when any field is undergoing, a revolution, a reform, when things become controversial, when we're not sure what we're actually looking at. Of course, this is irrelevant if we look at something like gene regulation, like no one really cares, right? But when things are actually important for us, when they have impact on our lives, then this is insanely important, and the public perception of science suffers so much from this infallible view on science.
Yeah, in a way, it's to go back to the sort of faith idea. We want the public to trust that the scientific consensus is the best model we have at the moment, and to follow it, say, to take vaccines or to stop using their car. But that it's sort of cyclical, because we want them to have faith in it because of the existence of maverick scientists who are prepared to change the consensus when it's necessary.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite a difficult set of logic to easily express to people without them having to go and do a full PhD or full scientific education to understand that's the way the system works, because it's just easier to be told stuff and be like, okay, that's now the thing, I will do the thing, that's not what we want to say anymore. We kind of want to tell people, think for yourself. You need to read the literature and come and see whether the consensus is there or not. And so then essentially it comes down to personalities and trust. And
how do you do that? How do you think for yourself if you have almost no knowledge of the subject? You will have to follow someone, and the one that in the end, it's not the one who has the best facts, but also the one who creates the best narrative, who gets the attention. And this is not only the case in the public sphere. This is exactly the same thing in the academic world.
Yeah, this completely comes full circle to your original starting sentences. Mm-hmm. We have to write good stories so that people read our arguments, engage with the arguments, and essentially believe our arguments. I often talk with some of my former students about that. I can't prove that the electron exists. I have a belief in the electron, and whether that belief is useful or not is then informs me as to whether I continue to think of the existence of the electron or not.
Right. I just had a different thought, which I didn't have when I was preparing the episode, actually. It's especially right now, where we are in a time where science on a particular subject is very controversial. I hate to go back there, but this is the corona crisis, the coronavirus pandemic. Two of the people here live in Sweden right now, the country which chose a very different path from everyone else. Could you say, therefore, Sweden is a bit the the maverick scientist in the corona pandemic. They paint their own narrative. They say, we know what we're doing, and you will see in time we did right.
I'm not sure if they are like following the maverick scientist story that much. I feel like there's definitely this sort of just wait, I'll prove you wrong that what I'm doing is actually better.
They say they trust the science. We believe science. It's not like we're not doing this because we want to save the economy. We're trusting the science.
Yeah, I agree that they say that, but I'm not sure how much stock I would actually put in that.
So, like, in a way, that the nice thing they're doing is providing more data points, because if the world all follows the same consensus, we won't know whether this was the right consensus, the right method, if lockdown was the right way to deal with the pandemic. But because we have Sweden who didn't lock down, and we have Norway, which is a very good control case study, we can now accurately, or not accurately, but it's a better way of measuring whether this was the right idea to do. So in a way, it's not this... Yeah, but they're sacrificing themselves, you two are sacrificing yourselves to science.
Not willingly. I did not sign the sheet for that study. So yeah, but what I was wondering about, do you think like that whole trope of the maverick science has changed over time, and then it was more prevalent or easy to do maybe in the Middle Ages or in the time between Middle Ages and now? Because I feel like it, like the whole thing has changed somewhat.
So I think I would personally divide it in three periods. That's like pre-scientific revolution. So what maybe you call this the Middle Ages, or let it be Renaissance, Enlightenment, all of that, where we had these gentlemen scientists. And science back then was very different. It was kind of exclusive to privileged white men that had money and were kind of bored and curious. And they could do science, like many scientists of the ages, of the centuries 17th and 18th and maybe 19th fall in this category. I'm not sure how it looks there. But then early 20th century, I think this was a very big thing. Like Einstein had this thing, this narrative which he created on himself, the hair and this picture with the tongue out. Like he tried to be a bit this maverick scientist against everyone else. He did the relativity theory all by himself and so on. While today it's again very different, because today we have Twitter and social media, and this again changes things so much, because the digital publications increase our reach a lot and how much we can actually read, but also Twitter increases our reach beyond publications. I think that's also not to underestimate.
Do you mean moving towards the political or public sphere, or do you mean between inter-scientists?
Both. Between scientists also. Of course, also the public sphere, because the internet is insanely strong, right? It's insanely important. But also between scientists, I think Twitter became more and more important for scientists who choose to use it, which is still not everyone, of course.
What I feel like the difference is, like, who are you fighting against, right? There was a long period of time where scientists were fighting religion, basically. Like the Pope could just come in and say, nope, you're wrong. God made it that way, and we're going to burn you, or like send you away if you keep insisting that you're correct. But today, that's a whole different story, right? If you are the maverick scientist, you are actually in conflict with the scientific community. So I think that's a big, big difference. Right.
I don't think we should include times of Inquisition. I think this is taken too far, because back then you didn't really have to be a maverick scientist to be against mainstream. You just had to be a scientist. like basically any scientific insight was against the
sure.
Catholic
there was
belief.
A lot of like for a long time there was a lot of science that one of their arguments, if you read publications from that time, one of their arguments was like, oh, and it's also correct because there's like a certain symmetry or beauty to it, and God only allows beautiful and symmetric things, and he wouldn't allow ugly things. So if you read like publications about physiology, how the how blood flow and that kind of stuff works, how the heart produced the blood and all these theories that were out there, like usually in those papers you find like a theological argument for these theories that they were
like post hoc. Yeah, of course you can always find it if you want to, right? Like lastly, the ultimate argument is always, oh, it's very beautifully designed and therefore God.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think you can dismiss it as much, but in modern times I don't think that the Pope's getting involved in a lot of cutting edge science anymore these days. So yeah, it's more like with the community, and it's almost like certain parts of the public against the scientific establishment, right?
Yeah, I think what is very important is what Chris said before, is the anti-vaccine movement. Then I think climate change is the other field where maverick scientists or people who paint this narrative around them are very important for the counter movement of people who deny man-made climate change.
I think this is something you've touched on before, where it's because that's where science comes to touch people's lives. Like, no one cares whether the mitochondria has DNA in it or not, because it's not going to affect them. But when scientists tell them not to drive their cars, then suddenly they can engage with it, or they have an opinion and or want to push their own narrative. So it's more, I think, in a way, you could reframe your question right at the start as to be, does the maverick scientist image bypass the scientific policy in government action or not, is the question. Because then I think it is a negative influence constantly on that.
That's a very interesting one, and I would completely agree. If people go out, they bypass the healthcare system and they start selling frequencies that heal the negative frequencies in your body, which is a thing, it's called bioresonance, and it's ridiculous. If you're doing that, then you're effectively bypassing science-informed healthcare policy, and that's bad.
Yeah, so I think in... To wrap it up then, the maverick scientist narrative for science itself comes with a lot of benefits. It drives forward the exchange and testing of ideas in a really positive way for science, and it makes people dedicate their lives to difficult questions. It's why the Nobel Prizes do seem to overly honor people with this sort of narrative. However, it's when that narrative is taken used by the public and brought against scientific policy, especially scientific policy in healthcare and these sorts of things, when it's used to justify your own inherent biases, then the narrative of the maverick scientist is dangerous, especially dangerous for society.
Thank you for listening. I hope we could contribute to your perception of scientists and how they engage with each other, but also everybody else. If you want to send comments, questions, or feedback, you can get in touch at Twitter at frn-podcast or email under contact@frn-podcast.com. This is something I've been saying wrong the last few times. I said our Twitter handle would be further research needed, but it is actually frn-podcast. So now you know. We also have a website, frn-podcast.com. That's where we would announce potential changes to the podcast, breaks, and you can also find a link to our Patreon and all other podcast hosters. If you want to support the show, consider becoming a patron. We have exciting rewards waiting for you. Music credits go to Jake Patterson. Thank you for listening, and see you for the next one when we talk about becoming supervillains.